The John Campia Show, in association with Designing Hollywood, presents... Welcome to the Designing Hollywood Podcast. I am your host, Robert Meyer Burnett. The Designing Hollywood Podcast is dedicated to all things movies, the movie industry, and its talented professionals. Today's episode is sponsored by Paris Costumes. Our guest today is an Oscar-winning British costume designer. She has created the looks of queens in The Favourite and Shakespeare in Love, mobsters in The Irishman, Gangs of New York, lush period pieces such as Carol. For more than three decades, she is no stranger to the world of Disney. Other impressive films she has designed that were nominated for Best Picture: The Crying Game, The Aviator, The Departed, Hugo, The Wolf of Wall Street. Straight out of college, she worked on music videos. Her first job when she was 21 was with choreographer Lindsay Kemp, who had taught David Bowie. But the aspiring costume designer's life would change when she met maverick filmmaker Derek Jarman. It was Jarman who introduced her to set life. Her first film was 1986's Caravaggio, starring Tilda Swinton, that he directed. She uses the power of clothes to bring to life some of Hollywood's most unforgettable roles. Her own sense of style is just as memorable. She has said, "The clothes are always made for characters. The job is not making actors look nice in clothes. It's about making actors believable as their characters, about making the story work." Without further ado, it is our great pleasure to welcome Academy Award-winning costume designer Sandy Powell to the Designing Hollywood Show. Sandy Powell, it is a great honor to speak with you today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
You have a very academic background. You've studied quite a bit before you got into this. You didn't just jump in. And one of the things that I'm a proponent of, and I think a lot of the people that have been on the show would say, that having an academic background and studying art, studying design, is crucial to getting where what you've done, where you are. Do you think that's true? And do you think that an academic background, even now, is important?
Yes, I went to art school. I spent 3 years in art school. I did a foundation course and 2 years of a degree course, which was theater design at the time. And then I dropped out. It's a bad.
So you're a punk rocker.
Yeah, I dropped out in 1980-81. I did not complete my course. I did not get a degree. I did not graduate. But I went with the intention of learning about theatre design and costume design, and I learned a little bit, enough to know that I wanted to drop out and actually go and work in the theatre, as opposed to sort of be told by people how to do school. So I'm sorry to sort of ruin your illusion, but I would never describe myself as an academic. I think I've learned more. I learned more in the first 3 weeks out of college than I did in 3 years in.
You have to have a vision, don't you?
Yes, of course, but you can't learn that at college or school. You learn that with life and experience. And I really do honestly believe that you learn more just by getting out there and doing it than you do actual study. Now, that's not to say that colleges aren't important. Of course, they are. Introduce a lot of people to things they wouldn't normally know about or be interested in. But I think the most valuable part is actual experience.
That said, how do you jump in and grab that? I mean, your career is astonishing. And what I love about it, like when I was growing up, Derek Jarman, as an American living in Seattle, I would go to the Seattle International Film Festival. I was not somebody who knew who Derek Jarman was, but seeing his films were very, I mean, very transcendent. It was not something that I was familiar with. And, you know, I was younger and in the mid 80s, I was in high school going to college. And when you jumped in to seeing these kinds of things, they really opened my perspective. And how was it that you came to work with Derek Jarman?
extraordinarily lucky, but I mean, I live in London and he lived in London. And I'd left college and I went straight to work with some people from the theatre who I had met. Admittedly, I had met some people who came to teach for a couple of weeks while I was at college. And I called them up and I said, is there anything to do? There was this very small fringe theatre company, of which there were many back in the early 80s in London, where there was much more funding for experimental work. Right. In what was called fringe theatre in those days. So I contacted these people and said, is there anything I can do? Do you have any shows coming up? Is there anything I can do? And I helped out on a production for the very first job I ever did. Then about 6 months later, they offered me the design job on their next production. I mean, there was very fast turnaround back then. So I started doing that and I did that for a couple of years. I also, at the same time, had met Lindsay Kemp, who, as you've in your introduction explained, was a choreographer, dancer, incredible, sort of extraordinary talent, who was responsible for teaching David Bowie and Kate Bush. And I already met him, and I kind of met him through chance, really. Well, not through chance. He was giving a dance class at a dance school, and I just turned up and paid my money and did a dance class and then approached him at the end and, you know, you're a huge inspiration to me. You know, can I show you my work? My little bit that I had, a few drawings. So kind of long story short, I mean, we became friends really quickly, very luckily. And he actually also invited me to Spain and Italy to do with in my first year out of college. So I'd met Lindsay Kemp. Miraculously done a kind of small production with him in Italy, and I'd worked with a small theatre company, and I kind of actually I'm really interested in film as well. And when I was working with the theatre company, I was designing the sets also, and I wasn't so interested in sets. I found I was more drawn towards costume and interested in costume. And I got Derek Jarman's phone number from somebody I knew, a friend of mine who'd met him in a nightclub in town. And I called him, I cold called him, I said, you know, would you like to come to the theatre and see a show that I designed? I'd love you to see it. I'll give you a ticket. And he showed up, he came, he was charming. I went to tea at his house afterwards. And he basically introduced me to the world of film. I'm making it sound like it's so easy.
Well, it kind of was.
I was just lucky. I think I was in the right place at the right time. And actually both Derek and Lindsay were people who really enjoyed the company of young people and what they both did. And I'm really recognizing that now, realizing that as what they did was they found it really, really important to pass on, you know, to pass on what they know. But that I think they also were inspired and energized by the energy of younger people. So I was just really blessed to have been mentored by two incredibly generous artists.
In this day and age, would you still recommend that for people that are aspiring into the industry? Because
I know
things have changed a bit.
No, it has, and it is. I mean, because I tell this story, I'll just call you up, and obviously calling isn't a good idea these days. I mean, you know, back then it was, you know, you might have to wait a few days to get a response because you might have to leave a message on an answer machine. You know, there wasn't any other way. Write a letter. But I would always say, make yourself known to somebody. I mean, I've employed people recently, straight out of college, who are people who have just made themselves known to me, who have, for one reason or another, have grabbed my interest. Mm. It might be how they look. It might be how they are. There'd be something interesting about them. I said, okay, I'll give you a go. And I think that's how it works.
Well, you know, you work with Neil Jordan a lot, and from The Crying Game, which I mentioned, of course, I was a huge Anne Rice fan. And the idea that they were making Interview with a Vampire was something that I was like, wow, because for me, Interview with a Vampire was such a cult novel when I was growing
up. So were you worried about the thought of making a film in case it didn't, you know, match up to your...
No, because I was already a fan of Neil Jordan's, and people forget that there was a lot of controversy about Tom Cruise playing Lestat.
Yeah,
and while I was like, the funny thing is, I always trust filmmakers. I'm like, they see things that we don't know. I mean, it's like, oh my God, Heath Ledger's going to play the Joker. How can he do that? Like, so when Tom Cruise was cast, I was like, clearly Neil Jordan, I will trust in Neil Jordan. And when I saw that film, which by the way, to this day, I love Interview with the Vampire. I think it's great, but the costumes, my God, you know, it was, and being somebody, that book came out, I think it came out in 1976, and I had read it like three or four times, and then Vampire Lestat came out. Why they didn't make the Vampire Lestat right away is one of the great mysteries of life. I don't know. But my God, was that film sumptuous. And the costumes, the way I was like, man, this was right off the page. And I'm curious, you know, when you're tasked with something like this, where does it begin for you? When you were given a project, I hear that, well, it begins with the script. Do you read the novel? Does it begin in your dreams? And I only because that, going through your filmography, before we get to Martin Scorsese or whatever, that film to me personally, man, was I blown away by that movie. And part of it was, you can't look at that film without being like, if I was a vampire, I would dress just that. How does something like that begin for you?
Oh, goodness. And now I have to cast my mind back. I actually haven't seen the film for years. And I've been thinking, and a couple of other people have recently mentioned it to me, having seen it. They've sort of watched it recently again and said that they've really noticed things they didn't notice before and really enjoyed it. So I do intend, this is one I do intend to actually watch it again. That's not going to be possible. But it was, in fact, my first studio film. It was the first film on that scale that I'd done. So prior to that, the biggest thing I'd done prior to that, just before, was The Crying Game. The last film I did with Neil Jordan was The Crying Game, which was very, very small. Mm. And at the time, contemporary. It looks like a period film now. It looks like a film from the late 80s, early 90s now, but at the time it's a contemporary film. And I immediately followed that with Orlando, which was a sort of costumey, sumptuous looking film, but on a very small budget.
Sure.
So Interview with the Vampire was the first time I had a budget to speak of, you know, and a much bigger, and everything was a much huger scale. So in a way, it was actually quite terrifying to begin with. I mean, the good thing was that I knew Neil and I'd already done two films with him prior. So I had that connection, which was would have been really, really awful or really intimidating to me and not known him. It was my first film. I had to employ an assistant who was much more experienced than myself, who had done films on that scale. So I had help in terms of organization and administration. How it came about, I really don't know. I can only assume it's the same way, it's the same system that I use on every film, which is the script, of course, read the book, because I thought it was important to read the book as well. Read the book, read the script, about discussed with Neil, and I guess just had to get on and start doing the research and coming up with the images. And I can't remember. I seriously can't remember. It's the same, you know. I had a workroom and a really, really fabulous cutter, and it was the first time I'd worked with her, and that was the start of a really fabulous relationship. And she did many films with me. I think this film was probably one of the few that I actually did have to produce drawings, because it was a studio and Tom Cruise and what's he going to look like? And I was relatively unknown. You know, I was a relatively known designer, and like, well, what's Tom Cruise going to look like? So I think I had to do element of drawing of like, this is the kind of shape he's going to be wearing in this period. Then we jumped to the period. This is the kind of shape he's going to be wearing there. And the same for the Pitt character. And then pretty much you just basically have to get down and start making clothes and doing fittings. And then as soon as you've done a fitting with your actor, if they're happy, and if Tom's happy, and presumably he was, I think he must have been happy, then everybody's happy.
Oh, well,
that's how it happened. But I can't tell you any more than that. I can't, like, actually cannot remember. I don't know. I can't remember.
Well, let me just say, as somebody who recently watched the film, the clothes are sumptuous. I mean, I, you know, if I was one of the undead and was an immortal, I would call you and ask you to make my clothes.
I guess somehow he must have had a lot of money, because they were sumptuous and they were made from expensive fabrics, and we did make them look wealthy. So I can't remember how he actually made his money. How does he make his money?
Maybe they invest. You invest when you're an immortal, and 100 years later,
I guess that's it. Yeah, it really, I can't remember. Yeah, how,
you know, you're
or where he bought his clothes, or who made his clothes. Where did he get them from? We don't know, do we?
he buys them at Savile Row. That's where he gets them. You know, yeah. Why not? Well, of course, you know, then you went on to do things like Velvet Goldmine, my God, and then Shakespeare in Love, which, of course, won the Best Picture at the Oscars. And, you know, I find that Shakespeare in Love is a movie that I, again, was enchanted by. I love that film. Shakespeare in Love is monumentally entertaining. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, you both have to, you had to recreate what it was like to work in the Globe Theater at the time. And then you also have to dress Judi Dench. And when you take on a project like that, what is your process? Do you research the period, or do you dispense with all that and go with your gut?
No, you absolutely, if something's set in a period, you always start by researching the period. I mean, that you have to research the period and see as much as you can about how it should be or what it would be or how it could be. You know, you have all of that information, and then depending on the project, decide how to use that information, what to do with it, whether to sort of think, okay, I'm going to try and approach this and be as historically accurate as possible, or I'm just going to take elements of this as inspiration and then go off on a tangent and do my own thing. Now, the thing about Shakespeare in Love was that even though it was about real people in a real time, in a real place, but it's a comedy and it's entertainment. So it's all a bit, it's a little bit heightened. You know, all of it is a little, it was a lot of artistic license. It was a bit sort of like if you were actually doing a theatre piece at the time, you know. But pretty much as possible, it was historically accurate. There were no anachronisms, there were no sort of modern touches or anything. But I sort of had to in mind that actually this was, and that's what was so great about it, that it was lighthearted. It's entertainment, it's a comedy. So I think, and I had within that, there were a lot of really great characters, good, funny, strong characters. And so that's the interesting journey. Actually, it's not so easy when you've got something like a Elizabethan period to do character within that, you know, because the shapes are the shapes. If you were wealthy, the silhouettes are pretty much the same. So it's quite interesting working out the little foibles and little details that define a character.
Well, it was interesting. After you did that, I mean, were you surprised that film won the Academy Award?
I was, because I was up against Elizabeth,
right,
the same year with Kate Blanchett, who was extraordinary playing Elizabeth I in a film that looked utterly gorgeous. Like Alexandra Byrne's costumes were like fantastic, and I was convinced of him because it was the serious film about a historical figure, and it looked gorgeous. Mine was the comedy. The comedy. I thought, well, there's no, the comedy's not going to win over the, you know, Kate Blanchett being serious as Elizabeth I. I was surprised. And it was also a strange year for me because Velvet Goldmine was nominated the same year.
Right, which was...
I was up against myself, and I loved that film. I loved working on it, and I loved how it looked. And so it was difficult, you know, it was difficult. But in answer to your question, yes, I was very surprised I won the Shakespeare in Love.
Oh, I mean, I have to say, I don't know why I've had to defend that film's victory, but I was like, no, that was the best picture of the year. I mean, in terms of what a movie does And, you know, it was up against...
As an all-rounder, as all-round entertainment, yes, I think it won the best picture,
You know, I always think that when films, in my mind, when people ask me a question, they're like, well, Rob, how are you going to do that? I'm like, it's a mystery. Yeah. I mean, to this day. So I'm like, that movie was great. In my mind, I love that film so much. It's so much fun, beautifully done. And then you began a long association with Martin Scorsese, how did you meet him? How did you come to work with Martin Scorsese?
It was just after I'd won the Academy Awards for Shakespeare in Love. I got a message that he wanted me, and did I want to read his script for Gangs of New York, which was being shot in Europe.
Yeah, so, in Italy, right?
In Rome, yeah. So I guess they were looking for a European designer for that. So that's how that happened. I got asked if I wanted to read the script to meet him. So of course I said yes, please.
The thing about, again, a film that I love that a film about New York was being shot in Italy, but again, the design work, I guess the word again is sumptuous. I mean, you had Daniel Day-Lewis as Bill the Butcher, you had Leonardo DiCaprio, you had a very specific period of time. But what one of the things I love about that film is it feels very heightened. It feels that it's a period piece, but it also feels like you're watching, in a way, almost a science fiction movie. Where how tied do you feel to period when you're working on something like Gangs of New York? Is it important to represent the period accurately, or do you get to bring a sense of design and be a little more theatrical with it and maybe go beyond what people of the day would wear?
In this particular, I was to do both. So most of the film takes place in the downtown area of New York, which was called the Five Points at the time. And Marty actually specified that he wanted that to be a little world of its own. It was sort of separate from everywhere else. Therefore, it could have its own look and its own feel. So it was sort of inventing a world within that period. We were around 1840 to 1860 is when it was set. You might recall in the scenes when they actually leave that world and go uptown, everything looks a lot more conventional. I mean, that's where people are walking around in like conventional women are walking crinolines, and you know, and they're, you know, you see horse-drawn carriages and sort of normal life. In the smarter part of town, it's more historically accurate. That's not to say that what we did do wasn't historically accurate, but there was, as you say, a little bit of artistic license. It was pushed a little bit visually. It was pushed and slightly stylized.
Loved it, by the way.
In order for it to have a look of a world on its own, which was a brilliant challenge and a very exciting thing to do.
Well, when you start something like that and you're dealing with period, and then also you want to, like you said, push it, how do you start? I mean, is the research important? Are you sourcing fabrics that are of the period? How much reality is important to you?
Well, the research, like going back to what we were saying before, the actual research is very important. The things that you look at, you know, there are paintings, but this was the time of early photography. So there was a lot of photographic reference and images, which was great. Daguerreotypes. And there were actually daguerreotypes, photographs of ordinary people, because mostly you normally get portraits. Painted portraits were usually of wealthy people. So as soon as photography came in, you then got access to portraits of people who weren't particularly wealthy. So you got to see what ordinary people wore. So the research, the actual gathering together of information and imagery is very important and very, you know, really vital part and one of the most interesting aspects of the job. In terms of sourcing fabrics from the period, that's pretty impossible. You know, I mean, you know, if you were buying fabric 19th century, you can buy fabrics from the 19th century, but there'd be really small pieces and the chances are they'll be brittle and fall apart. So I used fabrics that obviously you can only use the fabrics that are accessible and produced now in contemporary times. And, you know, you have to use fabrics that look like they could have been from that period. I mean, natural fibers, obviously wools and cottons. I mean, people always have wools and cottons and silks. So that's pretty much what you use. And then you treat them and make them look as much as you can as if they've come from another time.
Sure. And when doing that, I mean, you had that movie has a cast of hundreds of people.
I mean, it was huge. I think it was so huge. I think if I'd actually thought about it at the time, I'd have been so terrified. I couldn't have done it. We just had to sort of go blindly into it and just keep going. And it grew as we went along, changing constantly. And the film just seemed to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And the shoot actually went on longer and longer and longer. It went on much longer than it should have done. So right. It just kept expanding, and we just had to sort of keep, you know, running to keep up.
Now, of course, one of the great things about that particular film is you have Daniel Day-Lewis as Bill the Butcher, and mm-hmm. that, what's it like for you when you work with, I've often said on this show that the first line of defense for any movie is that you have to hire great hair and makeup people and also the costume designer, because actors, you have to make sure an actor knows that they look great when they walk out onto set. It is an actor cannot think about. They have to have their character. They're carrying it with them, and for what you do, it is incredibly important. More people don't even understand how important that is for an actor. Bill the Butcher had such a great look. Now, when you're working with a director and an actor, what is that process like for you in terms of developing character?
That was an interesting one, because Marty was quite specific about how he wanted Bill the Butcher to look. He wanted him to look dandified, like a peacock, even though what his job was a butcher, and you wouldn't normally think of that as somebody who dressed up. That's what he wanted him to look like. It's a bit like a traditional gangster, you know, where they want to look good. That's part of the intimidation of somebody who is dressed meticulously and showily, really, in a way. So Marty, we had already discussed that. Then I met Daniel for the first time and let him tell me what he thought, and his idea was the complete opposite, which was like, oh, I think you should be really grimy and really down and really, you know, like really lived in, and, you know, I mean, the opposite. So I was like, okay, right. Well, Mr. Scorsese suggested that maybe, so I mean, pretty much what I had to do, I said, well, look, why don't we just try both, let's see what works, and why don't we start by making you some shapes, we'll make some prototype shapes for you to try on, and we'll take it from there and see how it develops. I mean, it's an organic process anyway. I would never meet an actor with a drawing with a designer and say, this is what you're wearing,
right?
Never. Because you don't know until you actually meet them, you see them face to face physically, and even until you start trying things on, you still don't know what it's going to be until a few things down the line.
Right.
Because it's an organic process. Things change, things develop, things move, people's ideas change. So that's what we did. I went away, having seen him, looked at him, and I thought, you know, his stature and all the rest of it. I thought, well, I want to make him taller. I want to make it, you know, I want to make sort of accentuate his long, slender form. So I made the top hat a bit taller than it would have been, the trousers a bit skinnier than they would have been. And from the first fitting, which was literally just some shapes, I mean, not in the fabrics or the colors that it was going to be, just the silhouette, he put it on and he got it and he liked it and he felt it. So I thought, okay, phew, that's it. Okay, we're halfway there.
Well, I mean, again, another indelible character design that his costumes, the way he looked, was so important to that character. And when you're doing something like that, you know, like you said, when you have a director tell you one thing and then an actor walks in and says, no, this is the way I see it, you kind of have to put on your psychologist hat. You then suddenly are caught between a rock and a hard place. What do you do then? Like, how do you, as a costume designer, you know, you're in a way, you're a therapist and you're a cheerleader, and how do you reconcile what the director might want to what an actor might want, make that all work without having it all go
I guess it depends. It depends on your relationship with those people. It depends on whether your relationship with the director is there and strong and you know them very well. And if you actually agree with the director and believe them, and then you hear the actor's point of view, and it might be that you have to sort of gently persuade the actor to come around. Or they might have very valid points that I might have to go back to the director and say, well, they think this. I mean, what I always do is get you into some clothing as quickly as possible. Let's actually, rather than talking about it and looking at it on bits of paper in 2D, let's just make something and get it on and see how it feels and see how it looks and see how it moves. And then we'll discuss it again later. That's how I take. I mean, basically, psychologists, yes, that's what you do the entire time, whole time. The minute you meet somebody for the first time, you've got to very quickly, you've got to sum them up physically, you know, look at them. You've got to figure out everything about them very early on, especially their neuroses. And they all have them. Everybody has them. We all do. And it's getting to that. And then really the most important thing is making somebody feel comfortable and making them confident in you, making them feel like you're doing your best to help them with their character and make them look how they are happy to look and how the director wants them to look.
Well, I mean, and you began a long and very fruitful collaboration with Martin Scorsese on so many films, where you did a lot of things. I mean, whether it was Hugo, whether it was Wolf of Wall Street, when you have a relationship, an ongoing relationship with a director, I mean, you're two artists, two collaborators. How does that collaboration begin and how do you continue to collaborate with a director?
I'm trying to think of, I mean, it begins obviously with a lot of talking, and you certainly do. I mean, and then someone like Martin Scorsese's time is very limited because there are so many people who he needs to talk to, or any director for that matter has to talk to all the heads of department. But you do get an awful lot in conversation with Martin Scorsese. You know, you have an hour with him and he will just like bombard you with information so much. And it's really difficult to take it all in and remember it. When you have to sort of, usually I have somebody with me so that they can then remind me of notes. Said. Yeah, exactly. There is that. And then of course, the longer, the more projects you do with each other, the less you have to talk. I mean, obviously you have the initial conversations about the concept and the vision and all the rest of it. You don't have to discuss every tiny little detail necessarily, because again, it's about mutual trust.
Sure. Well, what is that like? I mean, when you do your initial designs, do you sketch? Do you draw?
I don't actually. No, I don't. I mean, I sketch or draw for whoever is making the costume if they need me to do that. I do it for myself, maybe just work something out in my head, but it's not anything that I would show to a director or an actor. It won't look like them. It won't look like anything they recognize as clothing. Only I understand it, and the technicians that I'm working with will understand it. The reason I don't do a drawing of a complete costume is because I actually don't know what it's going to look like till we start doing it. I know a shape, I know a color. So what I usually start with, what I normally show the director, if I'm, you know, about this character, I have reference images that I use that I like for whatever reason. I might like a particular coat in a painting, or I might like a car. I might just like the feeling. I might like the essence or whatever this picture is. But I'll have quite a lot of images for each character. I will then collect fabrics. I then start looking at fabric colors. I'll then have a color palette and various fabrics and textures. That's it. I'll say, this is it. This is the world. And, you know, if you have a visual director, they understand. Sometimes they don't. And I say, well, I will show you the fitting pictures as soon as I have them. As soon as I have something, as soon as I have an example or, you know, or a prototype on that actor, we will look at the fitting pictures together and then we can talk through it. But quite often now, I mean, they don't actually see the costumes until they're finished and on the actor.
I mean, wow. You know,
I don't actually do the drawings. It would take up too much of my time to do a beautiful drawing. And I find it really difficult working with sketch artists. I know a lot of designers work with sketch artists, and depending on the project you do, you have to work with sketch artists if you're working on those big concept movies.
Well, of course.
Which actually I don't do, but the people who work on those obviously have to work with sketch artists. Everybody wants to know what it's going to look like.
Right.
For those specialty costumes, you know, those ones, like superhero things and all of that. Yeah, of course I have to be interested. If I was doing one of those, I'd have to work with somebody who would do that kind of drawing. I mean, I can draw, I do my own style, but it wouldn't be the kind that would, you know, pass any tests on a Marvel, for instance.
Right, sure. Well, I find it fascinating because everybody works a little differently. And yeah. And to me, costumes don't really matter until you actually see them on an actor.
Exactly. You know, it's a tangible physical thing. It has to be in 3D. And I just think so often drawings are great. Drawings can give you a feeling of what something's going to be like. But I think I can provide other visual references for that feeling. I can provide the same thing without having to draw sort of a bit like what that person's going to look like. I much prefer working in 3D.
Well, and absolutely. And the work you've done, I mean, with Mrs. Scorsese, you've done so many different kinds of things. Again, like Hugo was a incredibly, again, the word sumptuous, all of your work, the word sumptuous comes to mind. But when you're working on something like Hugo, now that was a film that was actually shot in 3D, and it's a period piece, and there was lots of visual effects and things like that. When you approach a film in that way, do you do anything differently, or is costume design always the same?
That film was the first and only time I did 3D. And actually, we did have to pay particular attention to detail here, because, you know, you realize that if there was just a little stray thread somewhere, it would look like a piece of rope, 3D. Do you know what I mean? You had to really be careful. That's the only thing. It was just a speck of anything could be, you know, in the frame, because it would just be magnified 1,000 times. But I treated that film the same as any other period film. I mean, that was a film that was pretty straightforward period film with as much as possibly historically accurate what that one was. That was even though it was a fantastical story, it was sort of based in absolute reality.
Absolutely. I mean,
I think what makes it look sumptuous as a film is you've got Dante Ferretti, the designer, who is operatic in his scale, and then Bob Richardson, the cinematographer, who just lights beautifully. And I'm a big fan of color, and I use a lot of color. And I think all of those elements combined make, you know, give you sumptuousness.
Now, were you a fan of cinema growing up? Did you watch a lot of movies?
Yes, I did. Yeah. I think movies. Yeah, absolutely.
Did you have favorites? What were some of your touchstones when you were growing up? What were some of your favorite films?
I mean, very young. The first film I saw was Mary Poppins, I believe. So, Mary Poppins, Sound of Music. I wasn't interested in animation. Wow. So I wasn't brought up with the Disneys at all, even though I'm now working on them, on the live action versions. I never saw them as a child. I think the films that had the most profound effect on me were the ones I started seeing as a young teenager. So from about 12 to 40, 12 to 16, I think, were the films from the early 70s were the ones that I really loved. And they were quite grown up at the time. I mean, I remember seeing Cabaret as a 12-year-old. Even The Night Porter, Tolucci. I saw The Night Porter. I know, I can't believe I saw it. I looked quite grown up when I was young. I know.
You're like, I'm just a big Charlotte Rampling fan. I'm just going to go
I
in.
Know. I do remember seeing that. Yeah, I know. I can't believe it.
Death Great in movie, Venice. Though, by the way.
I mean, yeah. No, Visconti and Bertolucci I loved as a teenager. And that were the first films that drew me into costume in film, you know.
Wow. Visconti and Bertolucci, there's a duo. Wow.
Yeah.
I'm 12. I'm going to see the new Visconti film, which is fantastic.
I was a little bit older then. I was 6 when I saw it, in fairness. About 7 times, though.
Wow. Now, being enamored of cinema, what were some of the things like in terms of costume design, what you do now? Were there any other touchstones, like singular films? Look, I'm a huge Bob Fosse fan. For me, I'm a film editor, and all that jazz made me want to edit movies. And it was the first time I was aware of editorial. But what were some of the films that you'd watched where you looked at costume designer like, oh my God, that's it, man.
That was it. Death in Venice. Anything that Visconti did that Rotosi designed.
Wow. Okay.
Death in a Cabaret. You know, I love both of those. I'm trying to think what else.
Cabaret, as far as costume design, it's an amazing film.
Yeah. I liked either. I suppose I have always gone for grandeur or either sort of dark and, a cabaret. Rocky Horror Show, you know what I mean? That's a similar. Rocky Horror Show was a bit late in the 70s, but sort of. I mean, even Death in Venice is beautiful period, but the hats are enormous. You know, it's just sort of. I think I like things on a larger scale.
Well, there is sort of a heightened sensibility that you have that very a little bit more theatrical.
Well, I think that comes from my theatre background, really. I think that's how I started designing with theatre in mind. And I think that's what happened when I moved into film. I took a bit of the theatre with me. Obviously, it's that I don't design theatrically all the time because I'm aware that, you know, we're not looking from the back row. But there is always that. It's sort of maximum impact.
Oh, I love it. I mean, you know, movies, there's one school of thought that says, okay, we have to recreate things exactly, but movies inherently are dreams. They have to be heightened. They have to have, that's, you know, when I watched Interview with the Vampire, you gave me what I wanted from those characters. And I was like, yes, that's how they would dress. Because if you were the undead, if you were Lestat, he's not going to wear bad clothes. I mean, he's gonna wear the best clothes. He's like, yo man, I'm hundreds of years old. I'm not gonna wear something unless it's the most beautiful.
And he also has to go around charming people, charming yes. everybody. He has to be attractive to everybody.
Everyone. And you know, nowadays, of course, if you're Patrick Bateman from American Psycho and you're wearing your beautiful clothes or whatever. Nowadays, I don't know if people know, like, I don't know anything. I am not a fashionista. I wish, it's my blind spot in life. And I know my problem is I would love, if I was in that, I would want to wear the best clothes. I couldn't afford them. Mm-hmm. I want to spend money on independent movies. Your work, whenever you look at any of the work that you've done, whether it's a period piece or something modern, my God, I look at your work and I just think that's expensive. I couldn't afford to wear that, but that's why I love it. That's what the movies are all about. And you bring that sensibility to the screen. I mean, when a character that you've dressed walks in, they look like $1 million, even if they're in the 5 points and everything's dirty and they're a butcher.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope they don't look too good all the time, because that is the, you know, the point, that you do also have to do the people who look bad.
Well, I think they look good on the screen to be the yes. characters. That I think that's your great.
You can still make the dirt beautiful. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think that's a big, you know, that's a big thing to do. I think in a way. It's an art form that might sort of be lost, although it's coming back, because with streaming services like Netflix, there's a lot of period pieces being made.
Oh, I know. It's where all the period. I mean, there are not so many period films being made anymore, but I know that I noticed they're all coming out on the, on streaming.
Yes. It doesn't matter whether And they're playing fast and loose with periods now. Like,
definitely. That is the trend, isn't it?
Yeah. And why do you think that is?
I think it's what producers have always wanted when you do period films. I mean, in my time, sure. They always want to have a modern element or to have something that attracts. They think that people won't be attracted to a period film unless they can relate to it. Therefore, it's either got to have modern dialogue or it's got to have, and I was asked as a producer whether, you know, on Shakespeare in Love, as to whether Joe Fiennes would, you know, did he really have to be wearing those breeches? Could he not be wearing trousers? You know what I mean? Could not be wearing full-length pants because they thought that those shape Elizabethan things were a bit silly. It was like, no, we're doing a period film. Let's, you know, it's, so there's always been an element of let's do it. Let's, you know, and especially also with hair and makeup, you know, in a period film, so often you see the women with the hair down in a very modern, you know, where it would never be down, it would be up. All of right. that. It's always been popular. People always think that in order to be popular, they have to be relevant to now, which is sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I mean, I think some things work really brilliantly, and if it's done well and cleverly, it can work. Other times, I just think it looks a bit shoddy and doesn't work.
Yeah, I it's
now weird. It's definitely, there is a style now that it's worked for a couple of the first series of things that were successful. Now what's happening is everybody's just using the same formula. That works. Let's just copy it. And then it becomes boring.
Yes, I agree. But you know what wasn't boring? Mary Poppins Returns. People always ask me about some of my favorite fantasy films. And they're always shocked when I say, well, Mary Poppins. I think Mary Poppins is one of the great fantasy films of all time. And the idea that someone's going to come back. I mean, first of all, Emily Blunt, amazing. And when
perfect. Awesome.
Perfect. And I was enchanted by Mary Poppins Returns. I don't think that there was a movie that I was gritting my teeth to see, like, how dare you?
Yes.
And why would you do something like this? And you pulled it off. I mean, that film deserves, I think, even more credit than it got. When you're tasked with recreating one of the most iconic, one of the most favorite, one of the most memorable movies of all time, do you run away screaming in terror, or just take the money and whatever?
It was Rob Marshall asked me himself, and it was, you know, it was like, do you want to do it? And it was like, of course I do. You know, of course I do. It's Rob Marshall. And I'd never done a musical, and it's Mary Poppins. But then, and then the next thought was like, oh my God, how the hell am I going to do this? Not, you know, disappoint everybody. But, you know, it's good to have a challenge. No, on one hand, yes, it was like, this could be a disaster. This could be really difficult. But, you know, I couldn't say no. I wouldn't say no.
I loved it. I mean, I thought what you guys did with that film was miraculous.
I think it's a beautiful film. I really do. I think it works on all levels.
I completely agree. But man, that had to be, I would have been terrified. I mean, I wouldn't have done it. I'm like, if I was in your place, there's no way. You know, but you.
You know what? It's often, it's good to be terrified. It's good to be. I mean, if you were complacent, oh yeah, I can do that, that's easy. You're not going to push yourself. You could do something that looks all right and looks quite good. But I think you've got to have a bit of fear all the time, every time, to push yourself further. And I think I think you can achieve much more with a little bit of terror behind you.
Well, now, I mean, now you're working on Snow White.
Uh-huh.
And again, if working for Disney, it's interesting to me that they have taken this to recreate their, I mean, Snow White was the very first animated feature film.
Yeah.
And it is arguably one of the most iconic, between Snow White and The Wicked Witch, in Western culture, the canon of Western culture.
I know.
Like these characters are some of the most indelible and iconic characters ever. And I think, boy, did you get the perfect person to play Snow White? I mean, after watching West Side Story, it's like, my God. And so when
I can vouch for that for sure. She is perfect cast.
Ugh. And
we were only 3 weeks, we're 2.5 weeks before the end of the shoot, so I've seen it all. It's
when you are given this job, I mean, obviously Academy Award nominations and all that, you obviously know that the industry has faith in you. However, when you get tasked to do Snow White, do you get scared? Do you like, what am I going to do? I can just copy the animation. What is your process? I mean, my God, these are those two characters. I mean, in my mind, if someone says the Wicked Witch, it is the witch from Snow White. That's it. That's the, in Western canon, there's like Jesus Christ, and then there's the witch from Snow White. I mean, what do you do? Like, do you take it on and just, how do you begin that process and how do you make it your own?
I don't know how to say without giving too much away, but similar to the doing Cinderella as well with her is, you know, I obviously look at the original and you have to use elements. There's a nod always to the original. There's an homage to the original, but then it's my version. And this, I say contemporary modern looking, but it's a new version. It's a reinvention of the same story and the same characters. That's all right. I can tell you right now. I can't tell you anymore. But
well, I mean, if you want, look, I had to stay away from Cinderella because I have to say, for me, again, I got dragged to see Cinderella. I'm like, come on. Okay, first of all, I don't know where Lily James came from. I don't think, again, perfect casting. Lily James as Cinderella was seriously. And again, great, great, great costumes. And but the thing is, to me, Cinderella, maybe it's because it's not as iconic as Snow White, you know, because maybe it's because Snow White has a Cinderella is everyone dreams of being a princess and finding their prince charming. But Snow White is very singular, maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's what it is. But working for Disney, I mean, going from Derek Jarman if Derek Jarman was live, I mean, what would he delight in the fact that you're working for Disney, or would he be like, come on, why are you working for Disney?
I don't know. I don't know. The thing is, I think what I try to do is I try to keep a balance. I don't just work for Disney and do that kind of film one after the other. I do little ones in between. Like the two movies I did two, one last year, one the year before, straight after the pandemic. I did two very, very, very small low budget films, the kind of films that I used to do in the early 90s. So very small low budget films, working with producers I used to work with in the early 90s. And so I balance it. I do the sort of art house little budget films alongside the big ones, which, you know, basically it means I can afford to do the small little ones, you know.
Sure.
If I want to. But what would Derek Jarman think? I think he'd find it a hoot, actually. I don't think he'd resent anybody doing a bit. You know, you're being creative and you're putting your own spin on it. And I don't think I'm not actually being dictated to by anybody about what I'm doing. I am very lucky and I am pretty much given free rein to do what I think. Obviously, it's within reason. Obviously, I'm not, you know, Snow White's not going to be unrecognizable. Everyone's going to know that that's Snow White.
Right.
And the same with the evil stepmother.
So, oh, I mean, it's so, I mean, these things are so iconic and so much fun. But also, you know, I have to... The Wolf of Wall Street, another film that I mean, my God, that movie is so wildly entertaining. Yeah. But that film also has great costumes, great suits, great Jordan Belfort, man, that guy knew how to dress himself, or at least he knew how to dress himself the way you dressed him. And
no, he did actually. He knew to employ the best tailors. That's what it was about. It was about employing the best tailors. They used to fly the tailors in from Savile Row. They'd come in, they'd fly them in just to do a whole bunch of fittings and do suits for like the whole, you know, the office.
Wow.
So they used the best tailor. That's all. It was about the money, you know. Yeah, he could afford to do that. So he got good tailoring.
Right.
I'm not saying he necessarily had good taste, but the clothes were made properly.
Well, and you could see that. And what you did, what you recreated on screen was great. Now, let me ask you, you know, you started getting everyone, I think, in our culture, you win an Academy Award. I got to ask, I mean, you've been nominated, you've won. What is it like to win an Academy Award for you?
It's exciting. I mean, not the moment that you do, you're talking about, or you mean like since having them?
No, I mean, I think the idea, first of all, the idea that you might win one, I mean, it's, and then actually, because it's all very esoteric. It's not like, you know, there's a rainbow that lands on you from heaven and you walk around in this rarefied air. But still, I mean, to win an Academy Award, to be nominated for Academy Awards, you've been nominated many times and through your work. Is it incongruous for what you do? Like, you know, when you're designing costumes and working with actors and being on set and working with the director and the cinematographer. But then when you get something like the Academy Awards, which is the exact opposite of what it's like to work on a movie.
Yeah.
It's a very collaborative process. It's such a weird, the Oscars is,
I think there are a lot of people who just assume that because the Academy Awards moment is a moment of glamour, and that's the bit of glamour. They assume that your whole life is like that and your whole job is like that. And you think, oh my God, it could not be further from the truth. It could not be less glamorous, you know. If you could really see, you know, follow me around on my daily life and in my work, you know, you'd see how unglamorous it is. So it's a little moment of glamour, I suppose. That's what I mean. It's very stressful being nominated, actually. It's
really,
especially, you know, it's stressful because then the pressure's on you to win, and it's like you've been put into this race that you enter yourself in for, and you think, you're on the starting line. And you're in, and you try to be like, it doesn't matter if I don't win. I'm very happy to be nominated. But then when you get to the moment, of course you want to, everybody wants to win. You're in that moment. You're in the race. You want to win. You don't want to, say, I'm not going to try. I'm not going to run very fast.
Right.
So it's kind of it's stressful in that you don't want to let everybody else down, because usually what happens is that everybody around you, the people that work with you, you know, because it's for them as well.
Sure.
And everybody's excited, and your friends and your family, and everybody's behind you. And you just, what if I don't win? I'm going to disappoint all the, I'm prepared to not win. But you feel really rotten letting everyone else down. So it's kind of it's actually quite a stressful time. That's not to say I'm ungrateful. I'm not being ungrateful about it. I'm just saying that's what it feels like. It's very weird.
Of course, but it's still very cool. Come on. Yeah. I mean, look.
Of course it is. Of course, I mean, it's really great to be recognized, and especially by the nominations come from the people who do the same job as you.
Yeah,
you know, they're the people who understand what your job is, and you know, they voted. So that's the biggest honor, really.
Well, one of the things that we talk about a lot on the show is when the new generation of people that. Now we live in a world where there's influencers and there's Instagram and TikTok, and there's so many ways to get your work out there. But one of the great things I think about cinema is it does require discipline, and it does require knowledge and history and understanding. To speak to people that might want to get into the business, is there any advice that you can give? How would you tell somebody that's like, you know, going into college that wants to work in film or theater, what advice could you give them?
I think the thing is to not think. I mean, I think the problem is a lot of young people now just think that, I mean, because there are so many reality TV shows where you can enter a competition and be nothing 1 minute and then suddenly you win and you're a star. right. Like overnight, literally overnight. I think there are people who think they can come into the industry, come in and then just be overnight, be at the top of the tree. Do you know what I mean? It's not going to happen. I think you've got to be prepared to work really hard, long hours, and do anything, things that don't really seem to be particularly relevant. If you want to be a costume designer, you might have to, for a while, be making somebody else's lunch. You know, as a PA or as a trainee, you might have to be doing things that you really boring, but once you're in the environment, you keep your eyes and your ears open and you learn. You know, you look and you listen and you ask questions and you learn. I think it doesn't happen overnight. You've got to be prepared to wait and be patient and put the out and do the work.
Well, also, I mean, you know, we talked earlier about your academic background. You said, what should people do these days? I mean, is it different? I mean, do you work on the job? Do you learn on the job? What can people do?
I think if you have an interest, if you have an interest in costume design, then you learn as much about that as possible. You don't necessarily have to go to college to do that. You can be self-taught. I mean, I knew how to sew. I knew how to make things before I went to college. I was brought up learning how to do that. My mother taught me, and I continue to teach my own clothes. I think actually understanding how, if you want to design clothes, you have to understand how they're put together and how they're made for. You should be able to do it yourself. You don't have to be the greatest tailor in the world or the greatest costume maker in the world, but you should at least have a go and understand how it's made. You should know about fabrics. You should know about, you should be interested in history and research.
No, I mean, absolutely.
I mean, I'm not a historian. I don't know. I mean, people seem to think I'm a, you know, I know intimate, you know, details about costumes from every period. I don't. I know the period that I'm working on. I research a particular period or a particular aspect of a period for the film I'm doing. I learn that. I retain as much of that information as possible, not all of it. And if I go back to that period, I have to start again, start learning it again. But you have to learn how to learn. It's good to learn how to learn and what to look at and to get inspiration from things.
Do you think that in terms of where we're at in the industry has really changed in the last, I don't know, 30 years. I mean, now we're talking about streaming and the difference between theatrical. I mean, now we're in a period where Tom Cruise's latest movies, you've worked with him. He's going to make his Top Gun Mavericks is going to be the first $1 billion Tom Cruise movie.
It's incredible, isn't it?
It is. And I had the honor of meeting him once, and we ended up in a room together, just him and I. We had a conversation for a long time, and it was an incredibly impressive guy. I mean, in terms of, we just talked about work, and but he talked about the changing industry, and this was back in the late aughts when he had done Valkyrie. Do you think the industry is changing, or is in terms of your work, in terms of costume design, like you said, period isn't necessarily, it's fluid now. We can do whatever we want. We can make something like Bridgerton, or we can, it doesn't matter.
I think it's changing. Yes, it's changing, but it's changing because, as you say before, there are so many more platforms. You don't just go into a cinema to see that film. You know, you have to wait for it to come out. You see it in that film for a certain amount of time, and then it goes away again. Now you can watch anything anywhere at any time. And there is so much content and so many platforms to see it all on. Of course it's going to change. Of course it develops. And of course there's going to be lots of different things. I don't think, for me, what's changed is the kind of old fashioned films that are being made. You know, I mean, I used to be really, really snooty about doing TV. People would say, would you ever design for TV? I'll go, no, I'm not going to design for something that's that small. You know, when TVs were that small.
Wow, okay.
I mean, I used to think, I don't want to design for something that's really small. I want to design for something that you see in a big, you know, on a massive screen, in a big room, in a big dark room. But that wasn't serious. Obviously now things have changed and TVs have got bigger. You know, you can have one that's your...
Yeah, I mean, I get right here. They're great.
And also now, of course, some of the best writing is on TV, you know, and actually I like the idea. I haven't done a series yet, but I like the idea of a series because you can develop, a character can develop. The story can be much broader and bigger than it can do in a 2-3 hour film. So there is all of that, which I think is good. And then the bad side of it is there is also an awful lot of trash. being made, and you have to sort of wade through the crap to find the good stuff.
So wait a minute, are you telling me that maybe a maverick producer could come to you and say, Sandy, it's, you know, I got this show on Netflix, or I've got this show. Are you saying you're out there? Are you available for TV?
Yeah, if it's the right thing. Of course, if it's the right thing and the right director and the right everything. Yeah, of course.
Okay, then what would
because what I was going to say about the kind of films that are being made, it strikes me that the sort of films that I spent most of my career making with a mid-range budget.
Right.
You know, I started off with a really, really low, the Derek Jarman end, the really low, low, low budgets, which are great when you're starting out and great when you're young. You can't, it's difficult to maintain that for an entire career.
Sure.
So I did the mid-range, you know, the Neil Jordan films. So the films of a middle scale, most of the period films, this sort of middle bracket budget. But now that has completely disappeared. It's either the student budget or the mega budget. There's very little in between.
If you could design your ultimate, what is your ultimate dream project?
That's a difficult one. I don't know. I mean, it probably would be a period.
Do you know what
but
period?
But a period where with a heightened reality. I guess my ultimate thing is absolutely based in a period where we can stylize it a little, and it's, you know, great writing, a great director, and a great cast, and great, you know, production designer, great cinematography, makeup. I mean, obviously for me, one of the most important things was working with hair and makeup artists who are compatible, you know, because that's the most important thing, because they you have to work really closely with them to complete the look. It's hopeless if you work with hair designer who's off doing their own thing that's completely different from you. Then you've got a head that doesn't match a body.
Well, I mean, you know? That was something that I didn't ask you about, but collaboration. I've often said on the show, the director of photography, the production designer, and what you do has to be simpatico.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, you can't be making costumes that don't work in the environments that you're shooting in. You have to have that kind of, and that's one of the great things I think about cinema, is that you're collaborating with other great artists who are trying to do the same things you're doing in their milieu, which is
amazing. And that's, I mean, the best end products come from when every single person has done their absolute best, but it's all come together perfectly, you know, and everybody's working with everyone else. I mean, it really does show if there's one, you know, there's one area that's not fitting in and not working.
Absolutely. Well, Sandy Powell, I want to thank you for this. It has been such an honor to speak with you today. And look, I know you're working on Snow White, and you're getting close to the end. You can't tell us anything about it, but my God, was it a great honor to speak with you. And I know this is a long time coming, and what a delightful conversation we've had. Thank you so much for being on the Designing Hollywood podcast. And I for one, as a huge fan of your work, I can't wait to see what you're going to conjure up next.
Thank you very much.
And a very special thanks to our sponsor, Paris Costumes. Paris Costumes has been a part of the history of the European theater, film, and television industry since 1856 and became 21st century tailors. They are known for being experts in hiring and producing costumes of all periods. Paris Costumes' aim is to become a 21st century costume house through innovation while maintaining the standards of tradition and quality gained over years since 1856. They offer a variety of services, fabrics, accessory samples, leatherwork, hats, shoes, uniforms, period pieces. Paris Costumes, a costume rental house for film and television. A special thanks to our producer and founder, Martika Ibarra, and of course, our co-founder, legendary costume designer, Marilyn Vance. And our new partner, John Campia of the John Campia YouTube channel. Thank you to all of our viewers for tuning in, and be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel and hit that notification button. And you can find the Designing Hollywood podcast wherever you get your podcasts, also on iTunes. Follow me, Robert Meyer Burnett, on Instagram, on Twitter at BurnettRM, or find me on my own YouTube channel, The Burnett Work. Thanks for watching. We very much appreciate it.